Welcome to Creature Feature, production of iHeartRadio. I'm your host of Mini Parasites, Katie Golden. I studied psychology and evolutionary biology, and today on the show, don't judge a book by its horrible jaws. We're talking about sharks, spiders, and other creepy crawlies that go bump in the night, and we're finding, oh, they have a sweet side. We'll get to know these nasty gnashers by a slightly different side of themselves. And we'll answer the age-old question, can you hug a shark? Maybe not. I wouldn't do it. But, you know, could you? Joining me today to make friends and finfluence people is host of the podcast Lauer After Hours and Jort Center, Christy Yamaguchi-Main.
Hello, Katie. Thanks for having me again. I would absolutely hug a shark, just to get that out of the way, given the opportunity.
Legally speaking, on this podcast, to legally indemnify ourselves, I would say don't hug a shark because it could bite you. But, you know, I think there are, a whale shark. Honestly, I'd hug a whale shark.
Oh, absolutely.
If it wanted a hug.
Like, what's another, I feel like a nurse shark is probably okay.
They might nip at you. I feel like it's kind of up to the shark.
Yeah.
I think, like, if the shark's not too dangerous, like a whale shark, but if it doesn't want to hug, I don't want to hug a shark that doesn't want to hug.
Sure, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Like,
consent is key there.
Yeah.
And if the shark gives you permission to hug it, then sure. Give it a hug all day long.
Right. But if a great white shark is saying, like, come on, bring it on in here, then I would be a little hesitant because got like a bib with a little human thing on it, like a human icon on it, like a lobster bib.
Yes,
with a human
exactly.
Being on it.
It looks just like you know going to eat at Long John Silver's or
right.
Something.
He's got like a fork and a knife, and he's licking his lips in a cartoonish fashion. He's like,
yes,
come on, give me a hug, human.
Exactly, or a baby shark. I will say, like, I have not.
Oh yeah.
I don't think I've ever hugged a shark before, but I've definitely, you know, pet a shark like a you would a cat or a dog or something at like the touch tank at an aquarium.
Yeah.
That's always
very cool.
Yeah,
baby sharks are some of the cutest little things in the world. They look like, I don't know, they look like angry little kitties to me, but with fins.
I think PETA some years ago was trying to start a campaign where they changed... Basically, they were trying to get the public to refer to fish and sharks as sea kittens.
Yeah, I remember that.
Good effort. I'm not not going to knock PETA. I don't want them angrily.
Good hustle.
Exactly. I don't want them coming after me or anything. But yeah, not all fish I think deserve to be compared to kittens, but definitely some of them. And I think sharks are included in that.
Have you ever seen a baby salmon shark? They are
absolutely
adorable. They got big ol' eyes. They're super cute.
Aw. Oh, my God. Okay. I have seen this picture before, but I did not. I thought it was like a baby great white or something.
No, it's a baby salmon shark.
Oh, wow. Oh, my God. That's adorable. Yeah, it looks like a like an anime version of a shark or something.
Have you heard of... There's a forum on Reddit called, I think, Tsundere Sharks. Have you seen that? Where they turn the sharks into like anime characters that blush and
they're like biting the hull of a boat and saying, "Notice me, senpai."
Yeah, exactly.
I forgot about that completely.
It.
It's so
it.
Good. It's so good.
Yeah. So in our imaginations, sharks are very cute. Of course, I don't necessarily advocate going up to a shark. I think most sharks just kind of want to be left alone by humans. And I'm joking about great white sharks, you know, wanting to eat humans. Typically, they just want to avoid us. In fact, there's that drone footage that shows a lot of sharks off the coast of California, more than we thought, further inland or closer to land. And it really demonstrates that these sharks, including great white sharks, just don't really want to have anything to do with humans. They don't want to eat us necessarily. They just don't want to interact with us. We're not their typical diet, and they just kind of want to leave us alone and be left alone. But that doesn't mean that all sharks are just kind of loners. In fact, there are a lot of sharks that do love to have friends. Unfortunately, it's not us that they want to be friends with, but they do want to be friends with each other. They are not just soulless predators with black eyes like a doll's eyes. They recognize the power of friendship. It's so cute.
That's adorable.
So new observations of multiple species of sharks seems to indicate that they form long-term friendships with each other.
What?
So, yeah, a study tracking the movements of gray reef sharks in the ocean near Hawaii has found that they seem to prefer to spend time with specific individuals, which indicates some kind of sharky friendship.
That's amazing. I had no idea that they, like, that they had the I guess, I don't want to knock the intelligence of a shark. I know creatures are intelligent and in all sorts of different ways, but I didn't know that they had like the kind of brain capacity to really recognize other shark friends long term.
Yeah, no, I get it. Because, you know, I think about intelligent sea animals. I think of maybe whales and dolphins.
Right.
I don't think of a, you know, typically you don't think of a shark as being an intelligent animal. You think of it as sort of this like swimming kill machine, but
exactly.
But yeah, they have the capacity, they have the memory to recognize their friends for years, and they have the emotional capacity to seek out that friendship. Now, there are some species of sharks, like great white sharks, who aren't that friendly with each other. They don't really form friendships in this way. It does, at least not our observations up to this point haven't really seemed to indicate that. But yeah, gray reef sharks, which are, they're an intimidating looking shark. They're a very sort of sharky looking shark. They grow up to be about 6 feet or 2 meters long. They're fairly aggressive when it comes to other shark species. They'll defend their territory, but they are very friendly with their own species. And the observed friendships between two individual sharks has been shown to last for years.
Wow.
The only reason we don't know how long it lasts is that the batteries on the shark tracking devices ran out.
What? And
yeah, so that's what I want in a friendship, one that lasts longer than a shark tracking device battery.
What do you think, like, so you think these sharks, like, do recreational activities with each other as well? Like,
yes.
Are they hunt with each other? They hang out, like, okay, yeah. Are sharks, is a group of sharks called a school, or is it something else for sharks?
You know, that's a good question. I think it is school.
So these lifelong shark friends
I think
met in school.
Is perfectly good, yeah.
Okay. So I'm just trying to give a little backstory to these shark friendships.
Yeah.
So they met in school, become lifelong friends, they have similar interests. And then human observers get real weird and put tags on them, and they outlast the human batteries, the tags. That's incredible.
Yeah. It's so poetic. It's like, you know, you've got shark number one going like, man, I'm going to be friends longer than this battery on this tag lasts. I think it's conceivable that these could be lifelong friendships. We just don't know because our dang batteries don't last as long as a shark's love for each other.
That's beautiful. I love this so much. Now, gray reef sharks, are those Atlantic or Pacific or just kind of like all over?
I think they're pretty cosmopolitan, meaning they're all over.
Okay.
But
gotcha.
I think, they're in the Indo-Pacific. They can be, they can go as far west as South Africa, or
okay,
as far east as the Easter Islands. So yeah, kind of in that region.
Something that I've learned recently is just how like great whites in particular are literally all over the world. Like, I don't think there's an ocean, or there might be, but that great whites don't travel through. They swim such long distances, and I wasn't sure if that was unique to that species or if a lot of other sharks did the same thing.
Yeah, no, a lot of sharks do cover wide areas of territory. I mean, the great reef shark is one of these. Like, if you look at a map at their territories there, like, you can see them off the coast of Australia, off the coast of India, off the coast of Africa, off the coast of like Pacific Islands. So
wow.
Yeah, they have quite a wide range, and they can travel pretty good distances. In fact, One of the things they love to do together is they surf together. They ride waves in groups, especially with their friends, so they can relax and even get some sleep while traveling great distances together.
What? So they're boogie boarding with each
other. Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing. They're just, I love this so much.
They're just a bunch of bros surfing. It's so cool.
Like, I grew up and still live here at the beach, and it's one of those things that like, you always know when you're, you know, swimming out in the surf. You were talking about that drone footage earlier. You, like, there are sharks around you all the time, and it's once you understand that and you realize, I've never had an encounter with one, you realize how much they do to stay out of the way.
Yeah.
Of humans. They are not after you. You are not a fish. They know you're not a fish. And it takes a very large, like these sharks, you said they get up to about 6 feet long?
Yeah.
Okay. Like that's a perfect size for like a shark that like looks intimidating, but really poses no threat to you whatsoever.
No, they don't want to tangle with you. Their diet is fish, and definitely not human sized fish. These guys really, I mean, they really don't pose that much of a threat to humans. They might bite you, like if you really get in their face and you really threaten them. But
right.
I think most of these species that I'm talking about, in terms of like, because there are more, it's not just the gray reef sharks that form friendships. They tend to really not pose that much of a threat to humans, as long as you're not like really aggravating them. In fact, most of the time they just kind of want to get away with you and go hang out with their shark buddies.
Can I tell you a very weird shark story that I have?
Yeah.
So when I was like probably 8 years old, as I said, I grew up, you know, fishing around here, growing up at the beach. We went a couple miles out in the ocean, and my dad ended up landing a hammerhead shark.
It
was the scariest thing that I had ever experienced up to that point, because this thing was probably about 7 foot long, maybe longer. And I don't know the exact species of hammerhead, but he landed it. We went to clean it that night because we ate everything that we caught. We didn't do this for sport or anything. And I would never endorse anybody catching sharks now, but this was
the fear of sharks, as well as them being like in a lot of, I guess, dishes that are highly sought after, makes them targets for hunting.
Yeah.
People don't have sympathy for them because they think of them as just these monsters, and they're not. They're, you know, Jaws really painted a horrible picture of them, which is not
for
true.
For sure. Well, we took that shark home, we cleaned it, but when we cleaned it, or when my dad cleaned it, rather, I was, like I said, I was completely freaked out by this thing thrashing around on the deck of this, you know, small grady white boat. It had babies inside its stomach. And which is very sad, and not to bring down your listenership, but we were fascinated by it. We went and got alcohol and preserved these baby sharks.
Oh, wow.
And like gave them to our family members for like presents and stuff. And I had basically an embalmed baby hammerhead shark in my room for the longest time.
That is really cool and sad. And I have to see it. You have to show it to me sometime.
It deteriorated long ago. This was like 25 years ago at this point. Yes. So it's long been, you know, we weren't professional, you know, scientists embalming these specimen back then. But yeah, I had one for a very long time. So that's my weird shark story. Don't do that. Don't catch shark. If you hook one by accident, throw it back and pet it on the head first if it allows you, and then throw it back.
Say hi to your buddies for me.
Exactly.
And then toss it back.
100%.
In terms of threats to humans, so the gray reef shark is probably the most aggressive of the sharks we're going to talk about. They will attack humans. Like I said, they're pretty aggressive towards other shark species, and they defend their territory, and they'll do the same with humans, and they can do like serious attacks on people. I don't really think they tend to be deadly, though. It's just like you don't want to have them take a chunk out of you.
It's like a dog licking you. You know what I mean?
That's
like,
not true.
They're just wanting pets. That's all it is. They just want a hug.
No. They will bite you. They're sort of like imagine a giant chihuahua, undersea chihuahua with much sharper, powerful teeth, and you've got a gray reef shark.
It's like PETA would call them a sea chihuahua.
A sea chihuahua, exactly.
A sea wawa. Yeah,
a sea wawa surfing with their friends.
Exactly. Boogie boarding for some attention. That's it.
But so that's gray reef sharks. But sand tiger sharks are another group of cuties who hold fins and make friends together. Well, okay, maybe they don't like hold fins, but they will huddle together with their friends. So sand tiger sharks are fairly big sharks that can grow over 10 feet or around 3 meters long. They were observed during their migration along the coast of the eastern U.S. and appear to have complex social behavior and form friend groups. The groups tend to be sex-based, with females hanging out with each other and males kind of hanging out with each other. So like a middle school dance,
yes,
you know?
Yes, absolutely.
Where you have all the girls on one side and all the boys on one side. I don't know if that's the case anymore. Maybe the younger generations have fixed that sort of issue. But I know when I was in middle school, you would have like these two groups of scared kids where you had all the boys huddled together and all the girls huddled together. And sometimes you dare someone to go out and try to ask a boy for a dance. But
as the stepdad of three boys that have, come up through middle school not too long ago, it's still very awkward.
Okay.
It's 100% still like that, I think.
The kids have not solved that issue.
No, not
yet.
No. We they have to solve that before they solve like global warming and all the ills that
that might be just a thing that lasts for time eternal, like when
yes.
we're in robot bodies and we have the female and male robots, or probably we'll have all sorts of different fluid genders of robots because we'll become much more advanced
in
our society,
absolutely.
But then it will still be like beep boop. This is awkward.
Yes, we will have our utopia in the future,
yes.
Except for that.
Except
that will
for
still
middle school
be
dances,
with us,
we'll have completely advanced in our views on gender, except for middle school dances,
yep.
where we'll still find it very awkward. But yeah, so sharks, you know, have very awkward middle school dances, but the reason that they tend to make these sex-based groups is because the females are probably evading mating pressures when they don't want to mate, so they just avoid the dudes. And when sand tigers do mate, they nibble at each other, which I guess is cute. It's a little weird.
It's a very good idea on the lady sand tiger sharks. It's a good idea. They've got the right idea there.
Yeah.
Just avoid the guys altogether.
Yeah.
It makes life simpler and less pressure filled and all that good stuff.
Yeah. Just have a girls' day out. Just, you know, doing a feeding frenzy with the girls. You know?
Exactly.
I love a feeding frenzy with the gals.
They really are cuddling though. Like this one's got its lower. It's got its lower jaw resting on the dorsal fin of another sand tiger shark.
Yeah.
It's so cute.
Yeah. Yeah. They huddle together. They basically do everything except hook their little fins together and skip through a field of sea flowers.
of seaweeds, right?
Yeah.
it's adorable.
These guys also, even though their teeth look really, like you can see that picture of their teeth, they look quite intimidating. They really don't like to attack humans. They tend to keep their distance. They're not very aggressive. Obviously, with any shark, like you don't want to just like go up to a shark and if you're not like an expert and poke it on the nose because it might bite you because it's like, hey, get out of my face. Like you're not my buddy.
Exactly.
But like, yeah, they are much more gentle than they look, which I think is really sweet. Lemon sharks are another species of shark. They sound like they would be really cute little lemon shaped sharks, but they are actually really big and just sharky looking. So they grow up to around 11 feet, around 3.5 meters long, and they are found in the Western Atlantic. and they have very complex social lives. They like to form groups. Usually, their groups are based on similar age or size, although sometimes young sharks like to hang out with the bigger sharks to learn from them. It's sort of like someone in middle school trying to hang out with the high schoolers, like, yeah, I'm one of you. you want to see my Pokemans? Oh, we're not playing with Pokemans anymore. I'm sorry.
I love, is that so that's how lemon sharks sound? That's,
yeah.
Well, that's
little,
their voice?
Little lemon sharks, like little baby lemon sharks, right, trying to hang out right with bigger lemon sharks. Like, hey, guys, you want to see my Pokemans? No, we're eating fish. Okay. I guess I can eat a fish, but if you want to see my Pokemans later, I got a binder full of Pokemans.
I'm trying to think of what a little lemon shark's like Pokemon starter would be. Probably the, what was it, a Squirtle or like
Squirtle.
A Gyarados or something?
Yeah. Or like
Magikarp.
Yeah, Magikarp, definitely. But card's got a few bites taken out of it because they're kind of hungry.
I don't know my Pokemans well enough to know if there's a shark one. But
probably
maybe,
yes. Let me
there's gotta shark be. There's Pokemon. Gotta be, right?
Oh, I spelled it wrong. It's Pokemon. Yeah, there's lots of sharky Pokemon.
Okay.
Sharpedo. Okay. That's a torpedo-shaped shark Pokemon, who is a dual water dark type Pokemon introduced in Generation 3.
That's perfect. Yeah. And at Katie on Twitter with your Pokemon recommendations for little shark kids playing
great
Pokemon.
Yeah, man. And I got my shark anime. Have you seen shark anime? Tsundere sharks? Hey, guys. Where are you going, guys? Oh, I see you following the blood trail, huh? That's pretty cool, too.
I will sit here and let you do that as long as you want. I love that voice.
So yeah, lemon sharks, bunch of little cuties hanging out. Little sharks sometimes hanging out with the big sharks, trying to learn how to play shark games with them. And right, this group living can be beneficial to the sharks in terms of safety and hunting. But there's some evidence to suggest that they form friendships and social groups out of a desire for companionship, even when controlling for the practical benefits of being in a group. So basically, this research is trying to demonstrate that regardless of whether they would tangibly benefit from being in this group, they still form these groups because they just want that companionship. And it's similar when you think about humans. Like when we form companionships for normal people, non-sociopathic people, when people form a friendship, you think about, like, you're not thinking, okay, what is this friend going to do for me? Like, how am I going to get stuff out of this friend? Hopefully, in good friendship.
Ideally, right?
Ideally. And you form these connections because you genuinely want to hang out. And sometimes you do benefit each other, right? Like you do, it's like, oh, hey, you know, I know this great place to eat or something. And you get benefits from each other. But it's not, you're not forming a friendship just to be like, okay, I'm going to form this friend. I'm going to hang out with them in the hopes that they find a good restaurant for me to eat at. And that's your only, if that is, you need to rethink your friendship.
I think I've probably gone into a friendship with that motivation before. I'm not going to lie. It's like, this person probably knows where the good food's at. Or I know that they have a background in cooking or something. And like, I'm just trying to, you know, snag an invitation for dinner one night.
Like, no shame in that, as long as you also give as right, well as take in that friendship. But when we hang out with people and we form connections, it's an emotional thing. Like we don't necessarily think of all of this through, but we do end up benefiting. And this is in our evolutionary history. We are motivated by emotion to hang out with each other. And it does end up benefiting us in the long run in our evolutionary history. But we form these social groups not purely out of sort of a cold calculation, typically. And this is what these researchers are starting to think is the case with these sharks, is that they are forming these groups not out of like some kind of shark calculation of like, if I hang out with this group, there's more fish. It's like an emotional bond that they have, that it's kind of like when your cat, you know, your cat has an emotional bond with you. Of course, they just want food out of you,
right,
but they actually do form an emotional bond with you.
Oh, yeah.
sure, they're little satanic demons. I get that, but they do have the capacity, I think, to have an emotional bond with you, even though they are, technically speaking, just trying to get food out of you. It is, I think they have this genuine feeling. They want a companionship, so they'll come up and want to get pets and stuff from you, even when they're not hungry, even when they don't need food. And it's the same thing with these sharks. They want companionship, even when they don't. It's like not directly benefiting them in the long term, evolutionarily speaking. It does benefit them, but it comes from this place of emotional desire, potentially, which, if that's the case, this is really revolutionizing our understanding of sharks, because we don't think of them as being emotional, as being able to have feelings. You know, it's like they've got black eyes like a doll's eyes.
So, yeah, I mean, just the name shark is synonymous with like a person that is cold and calculating. Yes. and you know, doesn't show emotion and is kind of, I mean, just kind of a bad person, you know. Yeah. unless you're thinking of like a pool shark, but even then they're like coming in to take your money and that's
right.
It, and, you know, so yeah, there's no reason that we should have that preconceived notion about these animals, but, you know, because of human language and us needing analogies for things all the time, we wrongfully give people names of animals when they don't necessarily represent that animal whatsoever.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, especially with sea animals, marine animals, they've evolved so separately from us. I'm not talking about marine mammals, because obviously we share an evolutionary history with them, but marine, right. Other marine animals like sharks, fish, you know, cephalopods like squid and octopuses, which again, we've learned that octopuses and have potentially very complex emotions and intelligence. But they don't have, we don't see, their body signals are so different from any mammal. Like, we can kind of read the mood of a dog. We've co-evolved right. with a dog. We can kind of intuitively understand what mood a dog is in. We can even read the mood of something that we haven't maybe co-evolved with as much. If you see like a lion or something, you can kind of get a sense of the lion, what the lion is feeling. Maybe not always accurately, but we can read their expressions somewhat. A shark, they're unreadable to us.
Yeah,
they're so alien that looking at a shark face, they don't have expressions. They don't really have facial expressions that we can read. Their body expressions are inscrutable. So we kind of just assume, I guess, that they don't have emotions, when, of course, that's probably not true. They probably do have an emotional life. Especially, I think carnivores, predators, are often more intelligent because they have to be. They have to have some intelligence to hunt. Hunting is difficult. So I think it would be surprising if one of these main predators of the ocean is not intelligent and doesn't have any emotional intelligence. I think that would be much more strange than something that has to hunt and you know, have this complex behavior, just like being an empty kind of like soulless robot. That
right.
doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I from now on, I'm going, anytime I see a shark wag its tail, wag its tail fin, I'm just going to assume it's happy, just like a
yeah.
dog, just like I would a dog. I'm going to extend that, you know, credit to the shark that it's in a good mood and it wants a hug from me.
This podcast is not responsible for loss of limbs encountered during the assumption that you should rub the belly of a shark, even if it looks super cute.
I want to rub the belly of a shark so bad. Also, like the lemon shark, you're right. Like the names for these creatures do so much heavy lifting as far as our preconceived notion, because these things are massive.
Yeah.
And the sand, like a sand tiger shark sounds badass. Like it just sounds like it is going to hunt you down. Same thing with like a thrasher shark, and a thrasher
yeah.
shark might, I don't know what the temperament of a thrasher is, but like these names, again, they give these preconceived notions of these creatures, and in reality, we know so little about them.
Yeah, thrashers are actually, they're threshers, which I don't
oh,
know.
Oh, that's right. That's,
I don't know
I knew
why.
That.
It does sound like thrasher, though, and they look intimidating because they've got this really long, spiky tail, and they leap out of the water really, like, they can do these incredible leaps. But yeah, they're no threat to humans at all, really.
See, but the name, and you're absolutely right, it is a thresher shark. I grew up thinking it was thrasher shark because
that's understandable.
Right.
Because what's threshing?
I don't know. Is that like some scientist's name?
Is it
a verb of some sort?
Let me see if I can look that up, because I have no idea where that came from. Why is it called a thresher shark? Oh, okay. So it's the name for their tail looks like a scythe, which I guess is like threshing when you're like cutting down wheat or something. It's called like threshing or a thresher. So since its tail looks like a thresher, like a scythe, that's why they're called thresher sharks.
That's super badass, actually.
It is very badass. They look really cool. They look scary, but they really are not.
That's what Death carries, right? He carries a scythe.
Yeah, a scythe. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, we should just call them scythe sharks. That's
badass.
Metal.
Hell
metal yeah. AF.
Love it. Love it.
Christy, what is your attitude toward spiders?
Love them. Absolutely love them. I love all critters for the most part, except for like the giant cockroaches that we have here in southeastern North Carolina that are like this big.
Yeah, no lie.
Those get a little annoying, especially when they fly right at your face.
When you're
like on the back porch. But when it comes to spiders, I will not kill a spider. I will let them live in my house. I always trap them and then rehome them outside. Because they're little spider bros. They're just trying to keep my house insect free, you know?
Yeah. I have like a size limit of spiders. I'll let stay in the house. It's sort of the opposite of like a carnival ride. You must be this tall to ride. It's like, you must be this small to stay in my house. But if they're under, like if they're smaller than like a quarter, then it's like, yeah, no, you can hang out in here. And if they're larger than a quarter, I do try to catch them and put them outside. I have once instinctively like stomped on a spider that was larger than a quarter.
No.
And I felt so bad. I was like, oh no, I'm sorry. But it was dead.
Oops. I feel like I just keep bumming out your listeners, but like I stepped on a wolf spider one time. And by accident, and just like hundreds of babies, that were riding on her back, just like it was like.
Did you kill Bambi's mother too?
I did. sorry to reveal that. But yeah,
she is the backstory of every Disney movie involving animals.
I killed Charlotte, and her babies parachuted away. What else did I kill? But just like the immediate kind of like, again, I love spiders, but the immediate visual horror of like 100 of them suddenly like, you know, crawling in all directions. It'll make you do a double take.
Yeah.
For sure.
No, I love spiders, but like I still have that instinct of if I see a spider, I have a startle reflex, which is why I unfortunately smooshed that poor little spider baby. Rip in peace. You were too good for this world.
Pour one out.
But I understand, like, being afraid of spiders is nothing to be ashamed of. I think we are very instinctively afraid of spiders and snakes and things that could potentially bite us and cause some problems. Although most spiders are completely harmless. But are there any spider? Because for the most part, spiders just want to avoid us. They don't, even the venomous spiders don't really want to have to bite you. They do that out of a defense mechanism. They don't, you know, chase after you to bite you. They want to be left alone. They want to leave you alone. They don't really want to do much with humans. They just want to snack on bugs and spend time alone. But there is an exception to this, in that there is a spider that just wants to have a big old party with other spiders and with humans. And it is the cutest little thing. The winner of Miss Congeniality Among Spiders, Chikungunya Bilde, who is a small heart-shaped spider from Bali, who is a sweet little cutie who wants to give you a big hug 8 times with each of its arms.
I love it. That's a heck of a name. Chikungunya bilde.
Mm-hmm.
It, so, okay, I see the little baby spiders around mm-hmm. it. And that is a weird, I don't think I've ever seen an abdomen shape like that. Like it,
yeah.
It's, it comes to like almost a spike at the end, but it yeah. has these two, it's got, Katie, this spider's got some curves on it. I'm just, not to get weird about the spider, but.
Real spiders like, have curves.
They absolutely do. Man, that is a weird looking, that's a bizarre looking critter right there.
Yeah, it's like its abdomen is kind of heart-shaped, although it's not quite got like the divot at the top. It's sort of like a teardrop shape where the pointy end is at the most posterior point and then it kind of bulges out. And then it has the thorax that is much smaller than it. Yeah, it is very strange looking. And it looks a little intimidating, perhaps, sometimes, like the that it comes to such a sharp point. I think it's kind of cute, but it is completely harmless to humans. So these little guys are very tiny. They're only about 3 to 4 millimeters big. They have a shiny black or black and brown abdomen that is that like interesting, like teardrop pointy kind of heart shape. And they not only like to hang out with their own species, but similar species as well. So many spiders are not social. They will actually cannibalize each other, or at least they'll cannibalize other species of spiders. But Chikungunya bilde likes to socialize not only with their own species, but with their close cousins. And they like to hang out in human areas because they like to eat our pests. So they will actively seek out human habitations, so gardens or agricultural areas, and they will eat the pests that plague our plants and our crops.
So this is a true like definition of spider bro.
Exactly. This like, is the most broest of spiders.
That's incredible. I love it. I didn't realize, so these things really are tiny though. Like they yeah. are almost microscopic.
You can see them. They're
well,
like...
Well, yeah. Not very well, probably, with my eyesight, but...
They're like... I mean, 3 to 4 millimeters, it's like... It's bigger than an ant, so it's like, the size of, like, a baby button. Like, a little tiny button that you'd have on, like, a baby onesie.
Okay. That's an interesting unit of measurement. I don't know that I know how big a baby button is, but I will look it up afterwards.
A little button.
Gotcha.
So what makes these spiders so interesting compared to other social spiders, because there are social spiders that will form these big like communal webs and hang out together, is that they don't just coexist peacefully with themselves, but with related species, and they hang out together, they eat together, but they don't breed with this closely related species, this cousin species. So they are not hanging out thinking that, oh, this is just my own species. It's not a mistake. They don't breed with them because they recognize this is not my own species, and they don't need them for reproduction or anything. They stay within their own breeding group of their species, but they still hang out with this other species to hunt and to find food and safety in numbers. So it's really interesting. And even when their population gets overly dense and food starts to get more scarce, they still don't resort to cannibalism. So
this is like, because I hang out with people that aren't necessarily, you know, that aren't really my speed a lot of times. I enjoy the company of all sorts of different folks, different types of friends and stuff. So, like, that's basically what this spider is doing, is kind of has a variety of a social circle, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, oh, you're not my species, but you're like a close cousin to my species. Like, let's team up. Why not? You know, let's
That's
just
cool
hang out
hell.
Together. It'd be like if we saw some bonobos and instead of destroying their habitat, we're like, hey, what? We're very similar. Let's hang
exactly.
out. Let's chill.
Exactly. Like, or like Jane Goodall did with the chimpanzees.
Right. Exactly.
You know, like that, man, that's fascinating.
It's like, you know, with, I mean, we kind of did that a little bit with Neanderthals, although there's some debate as to whether we killed off Neanderthals or just intermarried with them.
That didn't go too well for the Neanderthals.
Right, exactly.
I don't think.
But we did sort of breed with them a lot. And so, so there is still Neanderthal DNA in our DNA. But it'd be as if we just hung out with Neanderthals and we're like, hey, you guys are cool. And we just hung out. And, like, there was no conflict. Because, like, we didn't evolve from Neanderthals. We were, like, cousin species.
Right, right. We co-evolved alongside each other. We had a common ancestor.
Right, we had a common ancestor. We split off, and but they aren't, like, we didn't, like, evolve from the Neanderthals.
Right.
So, yeah, so we kind of, like, killed our... either killed our own cousin species off or bred them out of existence.
You're either a cousin kisser or a cousin killer, I guess.
That's a great way to look at humanity. And these spiders don't just stop at being friends with their cousin species. They also care for their own offspring. They feed their offspring while they're young. This is rare enough in spiders, but not only do they feed their own offspring, they take care of their neighbor's offspring as well.
What? They babysit?
They babysit and they feed these other babies. They have communal caretaking of their young, which is just the sweetest thing.
That's so bizarre. Like I, it, like you said, it's rare enough in like the larger animal kingdom for animals to do this, like to care for their young through, like particularly non-mammals.
Right, especially insects.
Like, yes,
like
yes.
Insects don't tend to, they don't do as much parental care as other species.
Right, they lay an egg sack and then they vamoose, you know, they're out of there. And then they have 200 children that, you know, immediately have to either become prey or hunt prey. So that is absolutely fascinating that these things babysit. And so, like, is it because, you know, like with the shark things, or with the shark population, they might have complex emotions that we just can't comprehend. With spiders, is there like a benefit to like there being a part of a larger spider population as far as food goes or defense?
Absolutely, yeah. No, they are definitely benefiting from forming a communal area because it's probably easier to get prey because they can find an area and team up against this prey. And like if they can't find food for their offspring, a neighbor maybe could find food for their offspring, and they can build a web together, so like they can have a bigger web that can catch more things. Also, by being together, they are safer, you know, safety in numbers, and they can fend off other spiders more easily, something that may not be as friendly. So there's definitely tangible benefits to them being in this group together. Whether this is coming from a place of emotion, like we were talking about earlier with like sharks and with humans, we do have tangible benefits by forming community and forming friendships, but we do it out of emotion. It's hard to say because spiders are very, very simple. They don't have the same kind of brain that, say, a human or a shark has. So to say, like, well, a spider forms these connections out of emotion, I think is potentially a step too far. It's impossible to know exactly what goes on in a spider's teeny tiny little brain. I don't know what, they may have some kind of reward system though. And it's hard to know, like, what is the distinction between like, say, a reward system that a spider has and like emotion in a more complex creature. And that's a question I don't really have an answer to. It's kind of like when you have a robot that you program to kind of have a reward system or something, or want to seek out something. At what point is that robot sentient? It's the same question with animals. Like, we know we are sentient, and we have a pretty good guess that things like apes and dolphins and elephants are sentient. Like, I think that's pretty clear.
Right.
But then as we start to get to more simple animals, like we get to sharks, and it's like, I think they're sentient. I don't know how much emotion they feel or what is the depth of their emotion, but I think they do feel it. I think that's a safe guess. But then you start to get to insects, and it's like, well, I don't know. I just don't know what the depth of their feeling is. I would guess they're maybe they feel existence to some degree, but it's very limited. It's right. like a very, just kind of very limited existence. So it's really hard for us to even conceive of what that's like, because it's almost like we're too complicated to sure, understand sure. what that would be like to experience.
It's like, you know, man's comparison of us to a being that could be considered a god, you right. know, an omnipotent, omnipresent. It's the same equivalent as a cockroach to us, you know, as far as like the complexity level
yeah.
goes, you know.
Yeah.
Not that one is more important than the other, but just the level of complexity there is something that the cockroach cannot comprehend, just like we could not comprehend
yeah.
A being that powerful. Well, I'm going to just assume that these spiders are having barbecues and mm-hmm. cookouts with each other. And
little fly kebabs.
Exactly. It's the same thing as like inviting your neighbors over for a cookout. Everybody brings a dish, you know, that way, like one person is not supplying all the food. It makes things easier. You know, basically like a potluck kind of
yeah.
thing situation going on, and they're having a good time. They probably listen to music of some sort that we can't yeah. comprehend because we're not spiders.
There's a little spider manning the grill with a little apron that says like, regurgitate food for the cook.
Exactly. He's got a spatula in all yeah. eight legs.
Eight little like, legs.
He's flipping yeah. Spider burgers.
Many yeah. little. They eat mosquitoes and whitefly, which are super annoying pests for humans. But he's just got a bunch. He's making a bunch of whitefly burgers and
hell
flipping
yeah.
everything.
Mosquito hot dogs.
They're also apparently very docile, and they don't bite people. So, like, they tend to be handled pretty well if you're very gentle. They just
this is
don't.
A perfect spider. Can I buy these online and just release them in my house? Is that legal? Probably not.
I don't
not.
Think so, unfortunately. I think you'd have okay. to travel to Bali to be able to meet one of these little guys. But
let one hitch a ride in my suitcase or something.
Then you're responsible for a new invasive species.
Exactly. Exactly.
Who could blame you?
Right.
But maybe a less charismatic insect that is a lot less cute, a lot less fun to look at, is the earwig. Now, there are a number of insects that even I am grossed out by, and earwigs are one of them.
Yeah.
I don't like to look at them. I don't like to encounter them. They're kind of one of my... they're kind of blacklisted from my home. You know, I have a few like cockroaches, silverfish, and earwigs have
you're just not on the list.
Sorry. Yeah, I check a tiny little clipboard and I'm like exactly. checking it. I'm saying, sorry, sir, I don't see you on the list.
Oh man.
They don't look great. Let's be honest. I'm not gonna right. sugarcoat it. They've got pincers on their butt.
Yeah, they've got butt pincers.
They got butt pincers. They are long, shiny, black, sometimes sort of brownish. They move in that slithery, unsettling manner because they're segmented and they kind of have a little bit of the centipede movement, but they also have butt pincers. And yeah, no, I they're gross.
We have the European earwig here in North Carolina that we get in the house sometimes. And they're also like the one that you've got here in front of me has like some cool coloring to it. Like it almost looks like a fiddler crab claw, the pincer on the butt yeah. does, you know, it's got like a bright red to it. And then its back is like silver, but this kind in North Carolina is like, I don't know if you can see that.
Let's see.
No, it's blurring it. It's like brown. It's just like cockroach
yeah, no,
color.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen
so
that kind. Yeah.
It looks like a cockroach to begin with. Then it's got, like you said, the centipede wiggliness of its like segmented, what is that, thorax?
They've got the thorax is the upper body. The abdomen is the lower body.
Okay, so that weird I don't even know what to compare that to, but it like has that wiggly notion to it. And then those pinchers, do those pinchers, I will not bite because it's not
yeah.
their mandible. So
no,
is that what you call
it? They can use them to bite. They use them to defend themselves if it feels threatened, and they use them to hunt. So they definitely use them as pincers.
Wow. It seems
on their backside
kind of inefficient. Like, usually things attack the front, I feel like. But if you're a predator, I guess you bite wherever you want to. And if those it doesn't matter where those pincers are directed.
Well, it can curl its backside sort of like a scorpion. You know how a scorpion has its stinger on its backside. So it curls up and can sort of strike at things or defend itself. So that's how it uses its horrible, horrible butt pincers. And yeah, that picture that you're looking at is actually a St. Helena earwig of the Western Ghats. It's I think one of the coolest looking ones. It also looks like it crawled right out of hell because it's got those bright red pincers, a black abdomen, and then a silver thorax. It's super metal looking, very, very intimidating. But if you see those pincers, it's actually kind of a good sign if you're worried about them being parasites, because any earwig that has pincers is not a parasite. They can bite you, and they will if they feel threatened, but they will only do it in self-defense. They do not crawl in your ear and lay eggs in your brain. That's a myth. They, despite being called earwigs, they really don't want to have anything to do with your ears. The only time they would go in your ear would be on accident, like not realizing. And so if they've got pincers, they're not parasites. There are some species of earwigs who are parasites, not on humans, but actually on bats, but they do not have the butt pincers. They actually just look like weird large ants. They kind of look like between a Jerusalem cricket and an ant.
So that's an earwig I'm looking at right above it.
A species of earwig, yeah.
Okay, I would have never guessed that.
No, you wouldn't have. They don't have the look. They don't look creepy in the sense that earwigs do, but those are actually creepier because they are parasites. We don't have anything to fear from them, but they do feed on bats, which I think is sad because leave the bats alone. We love bats.
Seriously, I love bats so much.
Despite earwigs, the non-parasitic earwigs with the devil's tongs coming out of their butts,
Devil's tongs is such a good name for that. The devil's tongs. That's great.
It's true they might bite you if you handle them, but they just think that you're trying to kill them and they're probably not wrong. So, you know, self-defense. And other than their bad reputation, they're actually pretty sweet. They're amazing and loving mothers. So, like we talked about, you know, most insects are not that interested in caring for their young. Even like other arthropods, like arachnids, tend not to care for their young. Unlike the species we talked about earlier, the sweet little friendly heart shaped spider. But yeah, a lot of insects, a lot of arthropods don't take care of their young. Now there are examples of arthropods who do take care of their young. The heart-shaped spider being one of them that we talked about earlier. Scorpions famously carry their young on their back. And some insects do as well, including the earwig. And they tend to be very, very caring mothers. So earwig mothers are very dedicated to their young. Mom of the Year Award. They will fast for months, not eating, just so they can look after their nest. They will constantly clean their eggs.
Wow.
And if they detect pathogens in their environment, they will clean their eggs more often and be even more vigilant around their nests. So if they're chased away by a predator and they detect that there's pathogens, they will run back to their nest as soon as possible to start cleaning their eggs again because they do not want their eggs to become infected. And this is really important because earwigs can be the victims of parasitic fungus. And they are meticulous, just constantly cleaning. They'll even move their entire nest of eggs away if they are in danger. So pick everybody up and move it away, which is an incredible feat. And even after the eggs hatch, the earwig mothers continue to care for their young. So they'll help them hatch. They regurgitate food for the young hatchlings, and they will care for them for months until the babies are really ready to strike out on their own.
There's nothing like a mother's love, and that can't be expressed more clearly than regurgitating food for your young. honestly. It's the most beautiful thing that Mother Nature has to offer.
It's this, most animals do it. Humans are kind of the weird ones for not, you know, regurgitating food as a sign of love.
I agree. Any moms listening out there, if you truly love your kids, you will chew their food up, swallow it, then throw it back up for them to make it easier for them to digest. Just saying.
This podcast is not responsible for people who actually try to do that.
I feel like I do nothing but say irresponsible stuff on your show. I apologize, Katie. I'm sorry.
It's fine. We just need you to sign here and sign here.
Multiple waivers, documents saying I take responsibility.
You will be responsible for any vomit/shark-hugging lawsuit that we get. But yeah, no, it's something where you look at this thing, this earwig, it looks like some nightmare that Satan came up with as he was tossing a salad with his tongs and it's they are just sweet, loving mothers who care for their babies. Of course, like I said earlier, it's hard to know, you know, this is probably mostly instinct, like these are little mom bots that do these things out of instinct, probably not a lot of forethought about it. But, you know, it's I think it's still adorable and cute, despite what they look like.
I do, too. I love it.
So you mentioned earlier, Christy, that you love bats.
I do. I absolutely love bats. Grew up just seeing them around my house all the time, you know, like playing basketball in the street at night. And you could basically throw rocks up at the street light and they would swoop down after the rocks. And it was just a cool thing to see. We never harmed them or anything. I don't have any sad stories regarding bats, nothing like that. But they're absolutely adorable. They're so much cuter than people give them credit for. And again, and I think obviously this is the theme of your episode, like, bats have such a bad reputation. You know, I don't know if it's because of Dracula or the whole like spooky aspect of them around Halloween, but they get a bum rap and they shouldn't. They absolutely should not.
Yeah, and we talked about this on our episode called The Origin of Feces, where we had Rodrigo Medellin, who is a professor of bat ecology at the University of Mexico, and he's known as the Batman of Mexico because he's done so much for the conservation of long-nosed bats. And if you love bats, please listen to that episode. It's a great interview. He's a wonderful, fascinating guy, and we talk about, like, he loves bats and he wants to talk about like the benefits of bats to humanity and how they truly get an undeserved reputation. And I think one of the species of bats who kind of gets like the worst reputation of the bats is the vampire bats. And, you know, despite being only there's over 1,000 species of bats, only 3 species of bats are vampire bats that actually drink blood. And everyone, for whatever reason, this is the most sensational kind of thing. People have this idea that most bats drink blood. The majority of bats do not drink blood. Most of them are frugivores, meaning they'll eat fruit, insectivores, they'll eat insects. And there are a few species that are carnivores. Those are more rare. But none of them are a danger to humans, other than, you know, the rare cases of rabies and so on. But the vampire bats themselves, I think, really get an undeserved bad reputation. And, you know, we've talked about them a little bit on the show before, the fact that vampire bats really don't tend to drink human blood. There's only one species that has been found to drink human blood. This is the hairy-legged vampire bat of South and Central America and Southern Mexico. And they're absolutely adorable. It's to me, they look like just like Stitch from Lilo and Stitch.
Yeah, that's exactly what it looks like, actually.
They're so cute. They got these big eyes. They got this cute little smile. They're furry. They've got little earsies. I would absolutely let this bat drink my blood if I knew there was if this bat has, like, he got his rabies test and, right, and he's right. Fine, like, you can absolutely have some of my blood, you little sweetie. Look at you, you're so cute.
I feel the exact same way. Yeah. He's adorable. And these things, these vampire bats are tiny too, right? Yeah. They're little guys.
Yeah, little tiny guys. They just fit in your hand, like in the palm of your hand. They're not, and they, when they drink blood, even when it's like these guys, the hairy legged vampire bat tend to drink blood from birds like chickens. Most vampire bats will tend to drink blood from cattle, like cows or pigs.
Right, right.
And they just drink a little bit of blood. They never suck their prey dry. That's a total myth. They don't kill their prey. The only time their prey dies is during the inadvertent transmission of something like rabies, which right. It's still pretty rare. It's like people think that most bats have rabies. That's not true. The majority of bats do not have rabies. It's just that the ones who do, there's sort of a confirmation bias, because if there's a sick bat that you find on the ground kind of struggling and who lets you pick it up, like that's more likely to have rabies than your average bat because it's sick.
Sure.
So I still do not advocate, you still be very careful around bats. Don't just pick up a random bat you find on the ground. Not a good idea. But most bats do not have rabies. They're not just a bunch of, disease things flying around. And the same goes for vampire bats. So they don't kill animals by drinking their blood. And they're all about stealth. It's like a little stealth mission. They wait until they see, sense a nice blood-filled animal nearby, and they drop down and quickly scamper over to their, usually an ankle or something, and just do a little incision with their tiny needle-like teeth. And they actually have really fascinating noses that have these little divots that can detect blood flow. So they find they'd be great doctor's assistants to help them find a vein to do an infusion, because they have these amazing little detection organs. But they find where they can get a good blood flow, do a little incision, and just sip a little bit of blood. And it really, it's not, especially when it's like something like a pig or a cow, like they're not going to hurt them by drinking their blood. They're not taking enough blood.
The animals don't even notice, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Most of the time, like it might be kind of irritating sometimes, but that's probably the worst.
It's like a bug bite.
Yeah, exactly. So they're really not scary at all. In fact, they're very sweet, and they will, in terms of bat society, they're very caring about each other, and they will share their food with their friends. So bats make friends too, just like sharks, just like people. They will form companionships with specific other bats. And so bats in general have very rapid metabolisms, especially vampire bats, and going without a meal for too long can kill them. So it only takes 3 nights of missing meals for a vampire bat to die of starvation.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's the saddest thing I've ever heard.
Well, don't be sad for too long, because bats will help out a neighbor in need. Bats will share food with other bats. If there's a bat who's hungry, one of their friends will regurgitate a bit of their blood meal for the needy bat. And then in the future, this bat will reciprocate, feeding other friends that need food and will help them out in hard times.
They'll pay it forward.
They'll pay it forward. They have a bat social safety net. They're more advanced than the U.S.
I was about to say, that's more than can be said for most of the 50 states and our federal government for the most part.
They don't even make the bats like sign up for food stamps. And
there's
like,
no means testing. It's just
no means
like
testing. There's no shaming. There's no
if you're hungry.
Yeah,
eat.
Just come and get a little bit of blood vom,
That's amazing. That's amazing. Do these bats, I meant to ask you, when they do the little incision, is there anything in their saliva that's like kind of a coagulation agent?
Like an anticoagulant?
I didn't know, an anticoagulant. I guess that would be the term that I'm thinking of.
Yeah, they have an anticoagulant. I don't think they have anything that like numbs the area, but they do have an anticoagulant that makes the blood flow a little easier.
These things are so highly evolved.
Yes.
They're so, so incredible.
Yeah, it is pretty amazing too that they have their little noses have these tiny pores that they can detect heat coming from veins, so they can get blood flow pretty easily, so that they can, so they're not they are surgical. They're like little tiny blood-sucking doctors.
That's amazing.
In a lot of species of animals, like, parents will often regurgitate food for their offspring. And in eusocial insects like bees and ants, they will regurgitate food for adults, but it's within this colony of, like, sisters, of relatives. Right. But it's extremely unusual in the animal kingdom for unrelated adults who are not interested in mating with each other to regurgitate food for each other purely out of a sort of, like, friendship bonding thing. That's rare. That is quite rare. And they will form these close friendships with each other. And researchers have studied these vampire bats, and they've found that they form these bonds by, they take it slow. They like to take it slow and build up trust over time. So it's not just like this unthinking, like, I will feed you and then you feed me and then we're good. Capiche? Like, they right. will slowly build up trust over time. So they'll start off with smaller gestures. Maybe they'll do a little bit of grooming. They'll, like, you know, check for parasites on each other, and they'll groom each other. And then after they've done some grooming, gotten to know each other, then maybe they'll share a little bit of a blood meal with their new friend. And then
a first date kind of.
Right, a first date. Deal. But yeah. What's so incredible is this can be completely platonic. They can have no interest in mating. And sure. it can be purely just a friendship where, you know, where you just regurgitate blood for your friends. And
yeah,
and
exactly. You know? Everybody, you know, that's a normal thing to do when your friend needs some regurgitated blood and you've right. got some to spare.
Right.
Then
exactly.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Hook it up.
And so basically if they are getting, they make these small investments early on in the friendship, basically to make sure that, you know, this is a mutual friendship, that they'll it's a give and take.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
they start to invest more in their friends. And then it gets to the point where basically, like, they will, you know, give them a good amount of food just like when they are in need, and then they'll get reciprocated. And so it forms this safety network, bat mutual aid. It's very cool.
That's amazing. That's obviously, these bats live in these huge colonies, and I never realized just the complexity and the intricacies of the. I mean, they're really societies almost,
yeah.
you know, like
yeah,
like you
absolutely.
could call them. They might not look like what we think of as a society, but when you have complex interactions like that, when you have basically bats getting to know each other and making sure the other one's cool and helping, like you said, bat mutual aid.
Yeah.
It can't be stressed enough how highly evolved these things are.
Yeah. And it's not just vampire bats. There are lots of different species of bats. Of course, it depends on the species. There are some species that are more solitary, but a lot of species of bats will form these big groups, and they all huddle together in caves or in trees, and they form these, like, big communes. And they are of a lot of these species of, like, communal animals, they're very, like, pacifist with each other. There's not that much conflict. They're very chill, low drama animals.
Well, when you're that cute, like, you can't get mad at that face.
Look
right?
at the little baby. I included
adorable.
One of my favorite pictures of a vampire bat. It's a, I think this is a white winged vampire bat. It's just got a little smile.
Turned up nose. Yeah,
yeah.
Little turned up nose, the big ears.
They are so cute.
Oh, they're adorable.
If I could have one mulligan on, like, an unethical pet, like a pet that I really shouldn't have, it would be a bat.
It would be a bat.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've seen video of those golden flying fox bats.
Yeah.
Those
so
giant
adorable.
Ones.
Yeah.
And, like, I don't know if people are illegally keeping them as pets or if it's in a sanctuary or what.
Yeah.
But those things are the cutest, like, they're
yes.
cuter than, like, a lot of dogs that I see. You know what I mean? Like, they're
Have
they're
you ever
just...
seen them eating a grape?
Yes, yes.
It's so cute.
It's the most adorable thing in the
yeah.
world. It's like, it's the cutest video you could imagine.
Yeah.
But they're huge too. I don't understand the physics and the aerodynamics. Yeah, they're as big as small dogs, basically.
Well, they're little. Their actual bodies minus their wings is going to be smaller than a
right,
dog.
Right.
Smaller than the smallest dog. It's going to be their wingspan though is gigantic, because in order to hoist up like even something that's like bigger, they're like a little, their actual body size is maybe a little bigger than a rat, like a large rat. So they need a massive wingspan to keep them aloft. So like when you look at them, wings and all, they're truly giant. I also like that they're called megabats. The biggest megabat is the great flying fox.
Megabat is such a cool name.
Yeah, it
You're
is.
Absolutely right.
And they only weigh about a little over 3 pounds. Or 1.6 kilograms. Okay. So pretty small in total. But their wingspan is almost 6 feet or almost 2 meters long. So
wow.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Yeah. Yeah. So what you're asking, like, how do they even get in the air? That's the answer. They're pretty lightweight, but they have a huge wingspan, because the bigger you are, the bigger wings you need to be able to get up in the air.
This has been the most educational experience I've ever had with bats since Ace Ventura 2.
where he eats guano.
Yes, exactly. this has been so much fun.
Well, I'm glad to be in the company of a fellow bat appreciator. I love them so much. Obviously, we shouldn't keep bats as pets. I'm just saying, if I could have one mulligan on an unethical pet, it would be a bat, because they're so cute. But don't have bats as pets.
I might. It's illegal in North Carolina to own a raven, but I think that might be my mulligan, because of how intelligent those things are, and I love them so much.
It would be like living with a 2-year-old who can claw and bite at you.
Yes,
though.
Exactly.
Intelligent birds. As much as I love intelligent birds, I would never want one as a pet, because they would. It's like a little dinosaur that has the brain of a 2-year-old, and knows how to inflict pain. I have a friend who knows exactly what it's like taking care of like a cockatoo. And ravens are quite intelligent as well. Mm-hmm. I'm going to show you, I'll send you a YouTube video of someone who takes care of a bunch of big birds there's like a bird sanctuary, and she has a raven. And she's basically, this is not my pet. This is a raven who has decided to be my tenant in this aviary.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, we have to come to basic agreements, but if she doesn't want to do something, she's not going to do something.
Right, right.
So they are very independent. And so I feel like if I was to have an unethical familiar, I'd want a bat, because I think they'd just be real chill. I'd probably need more than one bat, though, because I wouldn't want to isolate them from their companion.
You have to have bat friends. But that's
live in a cave with a bunch of bats.
Yeah, that's under the same mulligan, though.
Mulligan, yeah.
Exactly. You don't need a bunch of individual mulligans for that. Like, the one mulligan
is a flock of bats.
Exactly.
And I'd let them all drink my blood, and I'd probably pass out.
Hopefully you're not iron deficient or anything like that.
No. That could get tricky. I'd probably get anemia, and I'd go to the doctor, and it's like, huh, you have severe anemia. It's like, it's fine, it's for all the babies.
Katie, has anything recently changed in your life? Any major, you know?
I adopted a flock of vampire bats. I switched to no dairy. It's probably the no dairy thing.
Probably the no dairy thing. Yes, exactly.
Well, Chrissy Yamaguchi Maine, thank you so much for being on the show today and for highlighting the sweet, cute sides of some animals who are unfairly maligned. Where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Wapplehouse, WAPPLEHOUSE. That's the easiest way to keep up with me and other shows that I host, like Lauer After Hours and Jort Center. And that's basically it. Listen to those shows. If you're a fan of Dan Lebatard's show, sports radio type of thing. If you're a fan of his show, we do a podcast that kind of revolves around that universe called Lauer After Hours. And then Jort Center Pod is me and four of the funniest people I have ever met or heard. They're just lifelong friends of mine.
And so you regurgitate blood into their mouths?
Yeah, absolutely. I have many times, usually after long night of drinking, you know, doing drugs and stuff, you know, it's a good hangover remedy, basically, is what I'm saying. Yep.
Bit of, you know, the saying, like, friendships are great if they outlast the battery in a shark tracking device or if they vomit a little bit of blood in your mouth.
You know, I think I have that on a cross stitch hanging up in the hallway. I think my grandma made one of those for me when I was very little. So
I've got one of those wood burnings that's like live, laugh, let your friendships last longer than a shark tracking device and vomit blood in your friend's mouth.
Yep,
it's a little corny, but you know.
Is it long winded? Sure, but is it a life? Is it a saying that we're very familiar with for a reason? Yes, because it's true. It's very true.
One of those eternal truths. Well, you can find the show on the internet at Creature Feature Pod on Instagram, at Creature Feet Pod on Twitter. That's FEAT, not FEET. That's something very different. And, of course, you can send in emails at creaturefeaturepod@gmail.com, where you can send in all your questions, your pictures of your cute little doggies and kitties and pets. And I'm also Katie Golden on the internet, at Katie Golden on Twitter. Thank you so much for listening. If you're enjoying the show and you have, like, just a minute to spare, you could press the star buttons, give it a rating. If you have even a little more time and you give it a review, I will read it. I read all the reviews. They absolutely make my day. They make me smile. Thank you for doing that. And thanks for the Space Cossacks for their super awesome song, Exalumina. Creature Features, a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts like the one you just heard, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or hey, guess what? Wherever you listen to your favorite shows, I don't judge. See you next Wednesday.